Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, welcome to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network.
I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Krieg, and we are the ladies of Groundworks, Inc. We design and build gardens in New York City and the surrounding area, and our podcast brings the culture to horticulture. So if you've been following along this year, we have been romping across the United States via the USDA zone map, and the zone map is what we gardeners use to determine what plants grow best in what conditions. It governs or it articulates the rainfall and the heat index, and it's what we all use to choose plants for our gardens. So it's been a really fun year. We're kind of winding down, sadly. We're in zone three today.
Yes.
Entering the cold zones.
Not our favorite, but interesting things are happening.
Super interesting things and great plants.
Yes.
And before we get into today's show, I wanted just to let our listeners know about an event that's happening at the Old Stone House here in Brooklyn, New York, on November 16th, everybody's favorite childhood book, Laura Ingalls Wilder. We're going to speak Marta McDowell, who's also been on our show.
A couple times.
Yeah. She is going to be lecturing on her new book, Laura Ingalls Wilder, at the Old Stone House. And it's $20. And it's Laura. It's the perspective of Laura Ingalls Wilder and land management, which is really interesting.
Yeah, Marta has a very interesting way to combine literature and horticulture and history and landscape all together in a beautiful package that kind of makes you rethink the books and the authors and the places that you...
Like her former... She did the book on... Beatrix Potter,
yes,
and All the President's Gardens.
Yeah, so, which was one of our most popular podcasts.
Yeah. So anyway, zone three, here we are. On this zone, or, you know, in each show per zone, we talk to extension agents and botanists and writers and growers who can reflect new and unique and relevant ideas per zone. So what we really hope to do is create zone envy and open up the world of gardening to you, listener, so that you will look outside your window
box. Look out from your phone.
Exactly. Look outside your window box.
And, you know, we started with zone 13.
That's right.
And I want to talk a little bit about zone 13, because after many weeks of trying, almost a month, more than a month, I finally got through to my good friend Scott Appel, who was on has been on the show many, many times.
In Puerto Rico,
in Puerto Rico, which is zone 13. In Vieques. So zone 13 has been devastated. And Scott finally was able to call me today and describe what happened from a horticultural perspective. He said every tree is defoliated. They yeah. are either ripped up from the root or completely leafless. He said the lawns look great because there's been torrential rainfall.
Mm-hmm.
His own personal experience, he had a very extensive tropical garden as well as a tropical fruit orchard and herb garden. It has completely been destroyed. In fact, the house next to his house was lifted up over his fence and dropped on top of his garden. So, but he's alive. He's grateful. He has food and water now, and he has some power with mm-hmm. his generator. So he's not in bad shape. And gardeners are resourceful people.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So he's already thinking about what he wants to plant and what he wants to produce for the future.
Right.
But I'm going to try to get somebody for our very last show. I want to try to circle around mm-hmm. and kind of complete the circle and try to have somebody from Puerto Rico talk about the landscape there and how it's regenerating, hopefully, and yeah. what farming and stuff is going to be like going forward there. You know, coffee plantations, all that has been kind of decimated. Scott said that, you know, being a vegetarian, he can't get any produce.
And he doesn't want to eat Vienna fingers.
No,
or he doesn't. Vienna
sausages.
He said Vienna fingers are awesome, actually.
yes, those are good.
Those cream cookies.
He said FEMA is giving out a lot of spam and Vienna yeah. fingers, and the churches too. He's like, and he's feeding them to the dog because he doesn't want to. He can't eat them. Yeah. The dog's appreciating them.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's get into our zone, into the zone, zone three.
Chilly zone.
Very chilly. So zone three is represented by a medium to dark pink on the USDA map. Its extreme minimum temperatures range from negative 30 to negative 40 degrees Fahrenheit.
Caliente.
Yeah, caliente. I want you to just sit. Like today I'm complaining.
Negative 30.
Today it's like 45 in New York when we woke up and I was like, damn it. You know, yeah, exactly. There we go. Dave. Yeah.
It's the howling wind.
Yeah.
So out of the Canadian Arctic.
Oh God. I'm not having zone envy. I'm really not. You know, maybe we'll find some redeeming.
August yeah, is the time to have zone envy.
To have zone envy, yeah. So you might wonder what people are lucky enough to live in zone three. And of course the obvious answer is a lot of people in Alaska live in zone three, and we're going to go there with our guest today, who lives in Anchorage part of the year. But this pink icy finger touches a few other states in the lower 48, as I discovered in my research. And also interesting, in the process of looking for zone three, I also discovered a geographic anomaly that I don't think a lot of us are aware of.
Carmen always finds the anomalies.
Yeah, because I study maps like other yeah. people study, I don't know, fashion catalogs.
Or finance. Yeah.
I just love maps. So as I was like trolling around looking for what areas to cover in this pink zone, which for me now is like also associated with breast cancer, which is really yeah. weird. Everything yeah. pink is
I was
breast
actually
cancer.
Thinking that, and I was like, I'm not going to say it.
Yeah, and also Pepto-Bismol.
October is breast month.
I know. Yeah. So we're in the pink zone. Anyway, so there's this place that I found. If you look at a map of the United States, most of the border with Canada is kind of like this, follows the parallel. I believe it's the 49th parallel that separates Canada and the United States. So it goes along, and then I'm looking at the map, and I see this like weird bump. And I'm like, why is there a bump in Minnesota?
It's the Lake of the Woods.
Yeah, the Lake of the Woods. So there's this place called the Northwest Angle. And that was in zone three, but it was not connected to the U.S. Like it's a landmass that's not connected. And I wanted to understand why. I was like, why
can
is
you
it?
Imagine the discussions back when they were like making the line? No, that's our lake. No, that's our lake. No, that's our lake.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, exactly. And I was like, wait a minute. The USDA map only deals with the U.S. Why is there a part of Canada in the USDA map. I was like, you know, our government is not that dysfunctional. There has to be a reason.
Oh, yes, it is.
So, well, well, maybe in a lot of ways, but thank you, Dave. But not in the map. I think I trust the map makers. I feel like they're like the most trustworthy people. So I started digging deeper. And I found out...
Map makers are the most trustworthy people.
I feel like they are. I believe in the maps. I really do. Don't take that away from me. The earth is round.
Anyway, but it was on a flat map.
It was. Yes, exactly. So I found out that this little patch of land is technically the northernmost part of the U.S. in the contiguous 48 states, right? You'd think it's Maine, but it's not. This is the most northernmost part. So... And the only way to get to this place by car is to travel through Canada. Okay, so listen to this.
Or you swim across the lake.
Across a very icy lake, which is filled with walleye. In case you want to go fishing, this place is also the walleye capital of the world. All right. So why is this little patch of land part of the United States, but disconnected geographically from the United States? Well, here's the reason. In 1783, something called the Treaty of Paris happened between England and France. They were dividing up the North American continent. So the British wanted to include the Lake of the Woods as part of their territory. But the map that they used for the lake and the surrounding area was faulty. Those map makers were not trustworthy. They didn't have GPS and Google Maps, all right? So they decided they drew the border between the two countries incorrectly, effectively cutting off this region from the rest of the territory, and it has kind of stayed that way ever since. So these people don't want to be Canadians, right? They want to stay American, so they just have to do a few things to accommodate that. So let me describe what life is like in this place called the Northwest Angle. Every time somebody leaves the Northwest Angle to get to the rest of the continental United States, they have to stop at a place called Jim's Corner, okay? Where they have to notify the Canadians that they are entering Canada. And how do they do this? They do this with a phone outside a shack that has a button with a Canadian flag on it, okay?
I feel like this is a Eugene Levy... like sitcom.
This is real.
Like amazing.
This is real. Yeah. So then you go through, let the Canadians know, you know, there's no wall or border patrol or whatever, right? You press a button that has the Canadian flag. You say, "Hey Canadians, I'm going to be passing through on my way to the United States." Now, when you get to the U.S. border, you have to let them know that you're entering.
Red Rover.
And what do you do when you get to the U.S. border? There's a button, and it has a U.S. flag on it. And you let them know that you're entering the United States. Also outside a shack, okay? There are, you know, security cameras, of course, and stuff. But
security cameras.
You know, which, of course, you know, but there's nobody there. It's right. Just a button, right? So anyway, it seems...
It's a cold button.
It's a cold button. So it seems simple enough, right? It's pretty simple. But everyday things take a really long time. This place has no grocery store and no high school. So every time you have to go food shopping...
Do all the kids have to make the phone call
every
day?
Listen to what high school... Now, this really touched my heart because I have somebody who just graduated from high school who complained about taking a train to school. So listen to what the kids have to do. So if you have to go grocery shopping, you have to pass through Canada, okay, to get to the United States.
Joe's Corner.
Jim's Corner. Now, the high school kids, they have to get up at the crack before dawn in the dark. They have to
walk barefoot up a hill through the snow.
Almost. Wait, listen. So they have to take a boat, right? They have to take a boat, and then they have to take a bus through Canada. They stop at Jim's Corner, of course, where the bus driver gets out of the bus and has to call in the names of every student crossing the border that day.
Wow.
So it takes like two...
This is like a cartoon.
It is. You know? I couldn't believe this was real,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So anyway, it's a beautiful place. It's remote. It's cold, but... this zone 3 covers this area, Northwest Angle, but it also covers most of northern Minnesota. And interestingly, the Mississippi mm-hmm. starts there, right? Mm-hmm. Just north of Grand Rapids. Zone 3 also covers the northernmost part of North Dakota, as well as the northeast part of Montana. And the Missouri River also kind of starts up in this coal country and goes all the way down through and meets the Mississippi in St. Louis. So this like frigid area is kind of like the birthplace of these big rivers that are really important for agriculture and for transportation, you know? Now, New York is not immune to Zone 3 as well. There's like this kind of pink splotch right in the middle of the Adirondacks that is Zone 3. It goes into Wisconsin, and our own Hudson River starts in Zone 3 in Essex County, which is like about 300 miles north of New York City. So we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to have our guest, Jeff Lowenfels, talk to us about life in Alaska and gardening and horticulture in Zone 3. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Hi, welcome back to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I hope
that was some knee slapping music there.
Yeah, that was really good, Dave.
It was awesome.
Very, very good.
America.
America. So today we're in Zone 3, and we have a really fascinating and funny guest to take us through the experience, Jeff Lowenfels. Jeff is the author of the award-winning book Teeming with Microbes, The Organic Gardener's Guide to the Soil Food Web, Teeming with Nutrients, The Organic Gardener's Guide to Optimizing Plant Nutrition, and in January 27 was published Teeming with Fungi, The Organic Grower's Guide to Mycorrhizae.
Howdy.
Howdy. I also want to say, Jeff, are you with us?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, great. I also want to say that Jeff is also a lawyer who writes the longest running garden column in North America, having never missed a week in 41 years. Is that true, Jeff?
Well, I think it's 42 now.
42.
But yeah.
Okay.
This is when I break down in tears. See how difficult it is to come up with a different topic.
Yeah.
Oh my.
A week.
Bless you.
Nice.
Anyway, the combination of garden writing and law earned him the moniker of America's dirtiest lawyer.
Nice.
Hey, but I don't use that anymore because I've got a trilogy, which makes me. Are you ready? Lord of the Roots.
You know, I really like that a lot better, Jeff. Jeff, I think that's a better moniker
Lord
for you.
Of the Roots.
Lord of the Roots, I think,
I like
is
that.
A lot. But on a serious note, Jeff is a highly respected and popular garden writer. He is the former president of the Garden Writers of America. He is a Garden Writers of America fellow, and in 2005 was inducted into the Garden Writers of America Hall of Fame, which is the highest honor a garden writer can achieve. So,
well,
yes, we have to, you know, we can't just goof around here on air. We
no,
talk about serious stuff
high,
here.
High sophisticated.
High sophistication. So Jeff now splits his time between Anchorage, Alaska and Portland, Oregon. So you're in Portland right now, Jeff, right?
I am on my way to New York.
What? Really?
Yes, I'm in Portland.
Great. Okay. So you had a really long and interesting bio, and I want to start by reading a little bit from your bio that you have on your website, and I quote, Jeff grew up as an indentured servant on his father's hobby farm in Scarsdale, New York. There he was forced to plant, weed, mow, pick fruits, flowers, and vegetables on an 8-acre gentleman's farm, replete with acres-wide vegetable gardens, a Versailles-style formal flower garden, 100-tree fruit orchard, and countless landscape shrubs, lawns, and decorative beds. He escaped to Harvard College, where he majored in geology. So, so Jeff, I spent some time in Scarsdale, and I...
We know Scarsdale.
Yeah, and I can't... I don't think of it as, like, a place that has... multiple acre farms. It seems a little bit
McMansion-y.
A little bit of an anomaly. So tell us about your family and their horticultural exploits, because it seems a little off.
Sure. Yeah. Actually, my grandfather grew up in White Plains on a 12 acre farm, which is now a subdivision.
Uh-huh.
And we grew up on an 8-acre farm. Gentleman's farm, as I said, right on the corner of Old Mamaroneck Road and Griffin Avenue, next to the Harry Winston Estate, the guy who gave the Hope Diamond to the Smithsonian. I think he mailed it to him. And I was the gardener on the estate next door, which was really just our little family farm. And it now has 8 McMansions on it.
So right.
You're absolutely right. But at the time, we had 80 apple trees. You know, we had orchards and cherry trees. And, oh, my God, I mean, that's, we picked and we weeded and mowed and raked and made compost. And because we were gardeners. That's what my father did. And if you wanted to be around him, then you went out and you worked in the garden. And if you wanted to eat, then you had to spend your time doing the stuff in the garden. So I just came back from my 50th high school reunion, and we were laughing about the fact that nobody else grew their own food in Scarsdale, but we did. So it was a great way to grow up there.
So does your family have a long history in the region?
Yes, long history. And so, and we had to take over a family business, and everybody wanted to be farmers, but we couldn't because we had to take over the family business. I tried for 6 months. I hated it. I went to law school, and one day I got held up and shot. And as I was laying on a little street, breathing through a hole in my neck, I said, that's it. I'm going to be the first in, I don't know how many generations to get away from a 25-mile radius of Scarsdale, New York. So that was it.
So that was my next question. Was like why did you choose Alaska?
Alaska.
Yeah.
Because as I was laying on the street, breathing through this little hole in my neck, dying, I think, my whole life passed before my eyes, and I suddenly came to 1959, when the National Geographic for the statehood Alaska was put in my bathroom, and there was a whole section on the Matanuska Valley and the giant cabbages and vegetables, and that flashed between part of my eyes. And when I woke up the next morning, I said, "That's it, I'm going to Alaska." And the woman who saved my life, I said, "Oh, and you're coming with me?" And she said, "Hey, okay."
Wait, so Jeff, how? Let's back up for a little bit,
because.
How and why did you get shot? What is that story?
Can you share about that? Because that, as New Yorkers, we're fascinated by that.
And I have to tie it into gardening. So I was on my third date with this wonderful woman that I met. I'd already written my parents and said, this might be the one. Back in the day when you sent letters to from Boston to New York, my God, anyway, because you wouldn't make a long distance call because that was too expensive.
Right.
So I was taking her to the botanical garden, and we were going in a particularly bad neighborhood, through a bad neighborhood, and we got, they wanted to shoot her eyes out, and I didn't think it was a great idea. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And
was this the Bronx?
Long story short, they shot me instead of her, and the next morning when I woke up, she was there. She was a nurse. She saved my life. And I said, "Hey, we've only gone out 3 times, but will you marry me?" And she said, "Sure."
So
something good comes out of anything bad.
So what botanical garden were you going to?
Wait, where were you in Boston?
Where was it? I was Blue Hill Avenue, Franklin Park area.
Okay. Oh, so you were in Boston when this happened. Okay.
All right. So you got shot while you were in school, but you finished and got your law degree, Jeff.
Right, right.
Okay.
And I went to a school where you travel, and so every other 3 months you go out and work for 3 months. And we went to Alaska. I traveled 36,000 miles during law school, so I had a great time. But Alaska was a terrific place to practice law, but it was also a terrific place to garden, I discovered, because, you know, the intense seasons, the light is phenomenal. Everybody does it. And it's just, you know, it gets you through life. And so when I ended up there, I said, gee, this is fun. And I used to write letters home to my dad telling him what I was doing in the garden.
Uh-huh.
And one day, long story short, I asked the publisher of the newspaper if she needed a garden column, and she said yes. And so I've been writing ever since.
Wow.
You know, it's just, you know, it was fabulous. A lot of fun.
What's the best article?
And as a result, just to tie it into the law stuff, I mean, you know, I was a lawyer there, and we know what people think of lawyers. And, you know, just one step above Donald Trump. Dun-dun-dun. Okay, sorry. You're supposed to laugh, guys.
I'm trying to keep up.
You funny. Wait a second, Jeff. You are, we have, to, I want to talk about. So you, what kind of law did you practice in Alaska? What were you doing?
Wait, let me finish my thought here. So when people see me in Alaska, I'm Jeff the gardener, not Jeff the lawyer.
Okay.
And it's a big difference. There's a big difference because you become a real person when you're a gardener. Everybody gardens. It doesn't matter what your philosophy is, political, da, da, da. If you're a gardener, you know, you cross all those lines.
And right. Okay.
And so that's fabulous thing to be up in Alaska.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. So, yeah. So all right. So you leave Massachusetts. You go up to Alaska. What? Tell me about like your early gardening experiences there in Alaska. You already had a lot of experience in New York because you've done, you know, you've worked on this farm and you've done all kinds of work. So you had some good skills. So what were the challenges that you faced when you to adapt to the climate and the landscape there? Because that's a big change, big zone change, big climate change.
Well, and it's an interesting, first of all, you had to figure out what zone you were in. So, you know, I always tell people, you know, the area where I am, Anchorage, which is where over half the population lives, is zone 3, 4, 5, 6. You know, it can be all of those.
Right.
I mean, our big problem, is the change in daylight. It's so fast in the fall getting dark and so fast in the spring getting light that a lot of plants, perennials, trees, shrubs, can't adjust.
Okay.
And so, they might make it in a cold climate, but they can't make it in a climate where the light changes so fast that they're not able to adjust their systems, which you can read about, I might add, in Teeming with Nutrients, which is the second book I wrote. Because it talks about what goes on inside the plant, and they just can't function quick enough. But so you had to figure that out, and then you had to figure out when to start stuff, because you obviously couldn't start a lot of stuff outside,
mm-hmm.
and so you had to learn how to do a lot of indoor gardening in prep for outdoor gardening, which is different than growing house plants or herbs. You know, you're getting ready to take stuff outside in a big way.
Yes.
And then, of course, you have to deal with soil temperatures and then the extraordinary daylight, which can cause some real problems. You don't grow spinach, you know, things bolt and, you know, go crazy in the daylight and da da da. So you have to figure all of those stuff out. And there was one book by a lady named Lenore Hedla, and my mother had given it to me while I was back in East, and so I had that with me. And it was a pretty good book, and so I used that as a Bible. But then I started writing these columns, and I really had to do some research in how to do stuff. And so my column became this is what you need to do this week, folks. And if you don't do it this week, our season's so short, you're going to miss it.
Oh, cool! That's cool.
Yeah.
What what was the thing that was most surprising to you? Was there a plant?
Most surprising to me was how easy it was to grow unbelievable flowers. I mean, I'd never grown a tuberous begonia. I'd never grown a fuchsia. I say fuchsia because that's how you're supposed to pronounce it, not fuchsia. They are the backbone of the hanging baskets of South Central Alaska. We were the hanging basket capital of the world, and oh my gosh, what a discovery for a guy from New York who'd never seen these things. And you know, I was into tomatoes and that kind of stuff, but whoa, unbelievable. So the flower growing, the annuals in Alaska are just beyond compare because the daylight is such and the coolness brings out the color and things like you can't believe. So that was a real eye-opener for me, and I just love the flower gardening, the annual flower gardening, which was not something I did a lot of.
So how long, what's your growing, what's the annual period of time in Zone 3 in Alaska?
Well, that's an interesting question because when people first came to Alaska and they started keeping records in the, 100 years ago, 120 years ago, it was a 61-day growing season. Today, in case anybody doesn't believe there's climate change going on,
yeah.
Today it's about 137 days.
Wow.
Yeah, that's an that's a statistic that you just can't fight, Donald.
No.
You know what I mean? Hello, Mike Pence.
Yeah.
It's warming. Anyway, so that's how long it is, about 137 days. We push it. It gets longer all the time. That was the other thing, how one of the aspects of gardening in Alaska became, we can do it, we can push the envelope out, we can bring something in that nobody's ever grown before, mm-hmm. push, and that's sort of a theme that works in the annual garden, mm-hmm. But I'm beginning to worry about it in the perennial shrub tree side, because we're beginning to introduce things that we shouldn't in the only place in the country where we haven't. And that worries me. So I got a conscience all of a sudden, and I'm beginning to get very worried about populating Alaska with non-natives.
Let's talk about this.
Yes.
That was a rambling answer.
No, this is brilliant.
Well,
let's talk about this.
I want to get into the landscapes of Alaska. It's a very big place. It's our biggest state, of course.
Right.
And I want you to kind of describe a little bit about the natural landscapes. And, according to the USDA map, Alaska goes from zone 1 to zone 8, which is pretty extraordinary when you think about it.
One
big state. So tell us a little bit about the diverse, ecosystems and
sure.
places.
Sure. Well, first of all, you have to envision how big the place is. So if you take Alaska and you put it over the lower 48 state map, it covers from Seattle all the way to Florida. I mean, it's big. You cut it in half, Texas is the third largest state. So it's big. Mm-hmm. And so, when you're down in Ketchikan and Sitka and Juneau, those are suburbs of Seattle. It's really, it's the same kind of weather.
Right.
And when you're up in Barrow, it's dark 6 months a year. In Fairbanks, it gets light for about 3 hours during the shortest day of the year. In Anchorage, probably about 5 or 6 hours.
Wow.
The shortest day of the year. But we have long sunrises and long sunsets, et cetera, et cetera. In Anchorage, we've got the current from the Japanese current keeping us like a New York temperature. And in Fairbanks, it's minus 75 all the way up to plus 95.
Wow.
We like to say, those of us that live in Anchorage, that Fairbanks isn't hell, but you can see it from there.
Yeah, what a swing.
But in any case, so writing a garden column is a challenge, and for a longest period of time, I just concentrated basically on Anchorage, and the people in Fairbanks just take it and they move it a couple of weeks. But that doesn't necessarily work because they get a lot hotter. We can't grow okra, they could. We don't grow tomatoes outdoors, they can.
Mm-hmm.
So there are differences. But generally, we all grow the same stuff because they're all the same cool seasons, short seasons, crops that need to be started indoors, et cetera, et cetera. So, and it's interesting to go to places where they read the column. If you go to Barrow and somebody comes up to you, a native person comes up to you and says, yeah, I read your column. And it's, I'm trying to grow carrots here, but it just doesn't work. So everybody gardens and everybody reads the thing because it's the only garden column there. So I'm lucky. I guess like writing in a prison.
So you describe the climate. What about the natural landscapes?
So the natural landscape is pretty varied as well, but it's got a lot of mountains. Our trees in the Anchorage area, South Central, where I say over half the population lives, are we have spruce trees. We don't have any pine trees unless you bring them in. We have birch trees and alders and willows, and that's basically what we have.
Willows.
And all of a sudden, you know, we come in and bring in mountain ashes and things that spread like crazy, and the moose love them, and they attract, you know, use them as landscapes along our roads. And anyway, you know, and the birds don't, it's a whole different shift in population. Our low-level stuff, we have, you know, anything from a fake tobacco-y kind of thing called kinnick, which is a, you know, ground cover, a lot of moss, ferns, you know, fireweed. It's a pioneery kind of conifery area. Now, South Central is different than where Juneau is, the capital, and Sitka and Ketchikan. Those have got a lot warmer climate, much more mountainous, much more rain. And yet we've got pockets of that all over our area. So you go 25 minutes outside of Anchorage, and you've got Girdwood, where there's a rainforest, and then you go the other direction, and that's where they grow the big cabbages. So it's a very, very varied place.
And it's really interesting to hear that everybody gardens, or a lot of people garden in Alaska, because you wouldn't think that, you know.
Let's talk about the soil in Alaska.
Yes.
Tell me about soil in Alaska.
Well, we've got the best soil in the world, which, of course, you hear everybody say, but we actually do. I sell it. It's called Alaska humus in its generic form. And what it is, you know, it's the product of 10 or 15,000 years of freezing and thawing and composting and microbial degradation, and it's beautiful stuff. And it's got incredibly high microbiology, which is how I got into writing Teeming with Microbes. Somebody came into my office with a bag of this stuff, and one thing led to another, and the next thing you know, I've got a book that's been translated into 9 different languages, and you know, and led to 2 other ones, which is kind of a crazy thing. But our soil is phenomenal. It's pristine. It's organic beyond belief. You know, a lot of soil in the lower 48 states is so depleted it's got less than 1% organics in it.
Right.
A really good organic farm in the lower 48 states might have 5%. You know, we've got soils with 56% organics.
Wow. I mean,
so, you know, forget you know, charcoal and paracotta. You know, I mean, this stuff is unbelievable, and so consequently we can grow a lot of different things that you wouldn't think we can't grow, and we can grow things bigger, and it's not the sun, which is what this is an interesting, everybody always thinks, oh, you grow the big cabbages because of the land of the midnight sun. It's got nothing to do with the sun, absolutely nothing. You could grow the same size, you know, right in your backyard if you had the soil
right.
In the area where they grow the soil, these big cabbages, traditionally, this is a little 6 or 8 inch layer right in the root zone. Mm-hmm. This humusy stuff.
It reminds me a lot of. I've spent a lot of time in Maine, and they have amazing soil too. And you're right, like it's geological, right? And there's people haven't ruined it.
Then you've got the volcanoes.
Yes,
up, you know, all the time. I've got 4 volcanoes that have blown up that I look at from my window, my bedroom. You know,
Hawaii. Hawaii's beautiful volcanic soil also is responsible for amazing produce. Mm-hmm. So, is there much like commercial farming at any level?
Oh my gosh! Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
We have, you know, the whole Matanuska Valley it's Sarah Palin, but it's also subdivision, but it's got a lot of farmland in it.
Yeah.
And the problem is we're so far away from markets that, you know, we don't have big enough markets. But yeah, there's a tremendous amount of stuff. You know, we've also got, in addition, we've got glacial flour blowing around all over the place. The stuff from, you know, glaciers grind up that rock. That's how that stuff becomes soil. And so we got it all going on in Anchorage, in Alaska. And it's just, our soils are phenomenal, very high microbiology, incredible mineralogy in it. The nutrients are simply phenomenal, and so it's a fun place to garden. Now, that also means weeds will grow.
So
you got to really do it. But everybody does garden because the winters are long, And so they love to garden outside. And we like to garden inside as well. I'm just making the shift now. I just sent in a column. Oh, my God, I don't know how many I've written. Well over 2,000. I just sent in a column. You know, it was time to convert back into the houseplant season because that's what we got. So, so everybody's got to, you know, start looking around, see where they put their amaryllis and get those Christmas and Thanksgiving cacti going. And, you know, the spider mites start appearing right now in the thrips because the heat's going on in the house. And, you know, we got all the little things everybody has. And so we concentrate on these things because these houseplants, A, get us through the winter, which can be really. And B, a lot of these houseplants are our connection to the lower 48 states, which is an interesting. You talk about heirloom plants. You know, when we're into getting heirloom seeds, we're all developing our own heirlooms up in Alaska. But our houseplants are things that we bring up from the lower 48 states that are our family reminders. So I've got, you know, plants that belong to my grandmother. I mean, everybody I know has a plant that came up in the back of their car, you know, and it's fascinating. It's a different kind of heritage plant, but it's very interesting. And everybody probably practices a little bit of that, even in the lower 48 states. Oh, yeah, this was my grandmother's. I had a cutting from this from my aunt.
Yeah,
right.
No, but it's all over Alaska.
Well, it seems like it's got more weight and importance in Alaska because of where you are and the remoteness to the lower 48. So, in a way, I really like what you just said about the connection to the rest of the world, or, you know, to the rest of the United States, because it is, that's exactly what it is. It's plants and people, right?
Do you stay, in Portland in the winter and then go to Alaska in the summer, or do you kind of go back and forth a lot?
Oh, I go back for that. I just, when I give lectures, it's just too hard. I'm too old now, you know, to get up and get on those midnight flights. So I got to have a place to break the trip up. So I come down to Portland and I give lectures. And so I'm back and forth all the time, depending on if anybody wants to hear my silliness. But it's fun. It's you get out of Alaska a little bit in the wintertime, you get a little bit different perspective.
I also, I think it's also really interesting that you studied geology at Harvard and, you know, and then you go to law school, but like here you are with this geology background and, you know, who knew that this was going to be your end point, right? I mean, you go to law school and usually that's the identity, but I love that you like went back to your roots, you know, and,
well, sure.
It's great.
Literally.
Yeah, literally. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
Well, I never really left them. I mean, the reason why I wrote the column is because it was my hobby, and I was able to turn my hobby into something that was, you know, useful to other people. And really, that's what gardening is about. It's a hobby, and people share information anyway, so it wasn't difficult.
Right.
And that's what gardeners do. You know, we may be a little bit competitive, but we share and we talk with each other and stuff. And so, you know, when I stumble upon the soil food web and rotate with microbes, you know, it was because, my God, this is information I think people need to know.
Yeah.
And then the second book, I was sitting around thinking, am I the only one who wonders how plants eat? How the heck do they get their food inside them? Mm-hmm. You know, teeming with microbes is how does it get delivered to them? Same with teeming with fungi. But how do they get inside? And what does it do once it's inside? What happens once food? And what, 7 to 18 elements? So why do we give plants kelp? They only need 18 elements. Why are we giving them something that's got sit? What's going on here? Anyway, it was, you know, so, and then I figured, well, if I'm curious, other people might want to know the answer too. And so that's sort of what gardening's about. You share information. You kind of pass it around, you know. And then the same thing with the fungi one. It's just, holy crow, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I bet other people might want to, you know. So I think
people don't, you know, now it's kind of gotten, so many things have gotten simplified. Oh, here's this rose food. Just use the rose food on the roses. Here's azalea food. It's already kind of been figured out for people, professionals and laymen. So they're not thinking about it. I have your book, Teeming with Nutrients, and it's really fascinating, Jeff. The beginning, especially when you talk about, you know, the fertilizer industry, how it got started. Alice and I have talked about that on the show as well. And I think you're right. People don't go deeper and really try to understand how plants, how they eat. Right. You know, and I would love it if you would. I know you have an entire book on the subject, but I wondered if you could share a couple of like interesting facts about how plants eat and how they take their nutrients for people. And because you in the book, you really put it in a really accessible language, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and it was Teeming with Nutrients to me of the three books. Teeming with Nutrients is the hardest to read. Yeah, you know, I swore I wasn't going to do any real hard chemistry, and so there are no chemical formulas in it. You'll notice.
Yeah,
because I don't. But what I found so interesting was that you know, plants have this very special membrane just on the inside of the cell wall. First of all, there are like 26 trillion to 36 trillion, I don't know who counts these things, cells in that tree you're looking at outside your door. You know, I mean, it's just 36 trillion cells. And each one has a cell wall. And just inside that cell wall is something called a plasmaderma, which is a membrane. And this is a plasma membrane, just like when you touch your television set and move your hand around, you know, you can see your fingerprints moving around. It's like this plasma, this kind of quasi-liquidy thing. And floating in this plasma are these individual proteins that act as channels and tunnels, each one designed for a specific one of the 18 nutrients.
Wow.
So if you've got the wrong nutrient, it doesn't go in that one, you know. Don't? And sometimes these little tunnels, which are, you know, proteins that are made inside the cell, are only used to allow 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 molecules to come in, and that's it. They're never used again. So there are these beautiful things floating around the inside of the cell wall in this plasmaderma, and they're the tunnels that let stuff come in. And once stuff gets in, then there are these enzymes floating around all over the place, moving around inside the cell, that take the individual nutrients and cling them together and make the various molecules that are needed for everything that's in that plant. And as I like to say, you may not be a vegetarian, but that cow you ate was, you know, basically everything that's in you. It's phenomenal. There are you know, 10,000 different kinds of enzymes inside each one of those 36 trillion cells, and there are maybe at least 1,000 of each one of those 10,000 enzymes inside each one of those teeny little cells. Ah, it becomes mind-boggling.
Yeah.
And eventually, when you finish reading the book, you end up remembering Horton Hears a Who. You remember that?
Yes.
Where the guy is holding, you know, and he's holding the little flower, and he's looking at it, and of course, there's this little family down there that call it the dandelion theory of life. You know, well, but that's what you end up realizing is that's what we got going on here in the world. We're just you and I. We're enzymes right now. We're one of the 10,000 enzymes inside a big cell, and we're transforming ideas and trying to put stuff together. And you know, and there's these communication systems. We're just like the communication systems that are inside the cell. It's phenomenal what goes on, and we never give it a thought as gardeners because we just don't, because they don't teach it to us.
Yes.
And so as a consequence, we're missing out on the beauty of what's really happening as our plants grow. And there is a beauty to it, and it gives the, you know, it's like finding the inner beauty in a person. All of a sudden, you find the inner beauty of the plant.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people see plants as static. You know, when you're growing up, you're like, what's an animal? An animal is something that moves. What is a plant? A plant is not able to move. You know, there's this like kind of simplistic
categorization.
Right.
And, you know, as a gardener and as a person, I see the miraculous in plants, you know? And I think more people need to see that, you know? And I think with your books, you write them in a way that is like interesting.
I wish you could have been my biology
teacher.
Yes. I wish I could have too. It would have been a lot more fun than being a lawyer. But you're right. I mean, you know, the reason why they're that way, and I really came upon it as I was writing Teeming with Fungi. You know, when you look at a book like these books, they're about 500-700 words, and then there's a little black line you know, heading, and then there's 500 or 700 words, another little black line heading. Yeah. You know, that's how that's how these. Well, those turn out to be, you know, column length. Hey, I'm pretty good at doing that. I've had some practice at writing columns.
Yeah.
So almost each one's almost a column, which is kind of fun. But teaming with fungi is even more interesting because it shows you the interrelationship between the plants. I mean, they talk to each other through these mycorrhizal networks. It's, you know, Paul Stamets and all that stuff. Holy crow. It's unbelievable. So you get a plant, you get a marigold growing in a forest. I'm just making these things up.
Right.
And an elm tree next to the marigold dies, and you would think the food goes into another elm tree, to, you know, a little seedling to keep the elm tree species alive. But that may not necessarily happen. It may go to the marigold.
Right.
Through the mycorrhizal networks, which become interconnected. Holy crap. It's mind-boggling. You know, again, we think they're static. They're not. These plants are, they can't run, but boy, oh boy, can they operate chemically. And they do. It's just simply phenomenal.
Jeff,
so
such...
I go crazy.
Jeff, such, like, big land, big sky, big ideas... And it's beautiful. Thank you for
my pleasure.
Yeah.
And I encourage people to buy the book. I also want to talk, I want to ask you about one last thing, Jeff, about the Garden Writers. You started one of my favorite of their initiatives, Plant a Row for the Hungry. And I'd love for you to share about how that got started and what that program is all about, because I think it's a really, really wonderful program that you initiated.
Well, yeah, the program's called Plant a Row for the Hungry, and I'm embarrassed to tell you that it got started because I was in Washington, D.C., literally the coldest week they ever had. They closed the whole town down except the tourists who were stuck there because the airports were closed. And the tourists were there, the restaurants were open, the hotels were open, but the streets were empty, and it was below zero cold. I mean, really cold. And I was walking to an expense account restaurant with my hand in my pocket, being taken out to, you know, dinner by some people, and a guy came up to me and wanted some food, and you see these signs all over Washington saying, do not give money to panhandlers. We have our own program. We take care of them. And so I said no. And the guy, he just wanted something to eat, and he said, listen, I'm hungry. I need something to eat. You can come and watch me eat. And I still said no. Oh, you know, and I a beautiful meal. I go back to my hotel. You know, not it's phenomenal bottle of wine at the bed, you know, left by the management, and holy crow. So I'm flying home first class, eating steak and zucchini, you know, and I got to write a column. And I'm thinking, what am I going to write about it? And I see the zucchini, and I remember the joke about, you know, you don't leave your car parked unlocked in Minnesota in the middle of the summer, because if you do, you wake up the next morning and it's full of somebody else's zucchini. and so, gee, you know, maybe I could, I felt so bad about this guy. I tried to find him the next day, and I had bad dreams. It was just terrible. And I came upon the idea that maybe I could get all my readers to plant a row in their garden to feed the hungry in Anchorage in Alaska. And so I wrote about it. I started this thing called Plant a Row for Beans. Long story short, the Garden Writers came up to Alaska 3 or 4 years later, heard about the program, adopted it as their program, as a national program, and we've collected 20, 30, 40, 50 million pounds of food. You know, it's just a phenomenal thing because there are no real rules. You grow the garden. You, the gardener, nothing slips between the lip and the cup because you take the stuff to the food pantry or to the neighbor that needs it or to the church or synagogue. You know, if you've got a prison program, you grow the food and give it away. Whatever, it's all Plant a Row for the Hungry. It's gardeners helping other people. We don't need the government. They're not going to help us enough, you know. So 1 pound of food, it can be 4 meals.
Yes.
So it's so important that we do it. And everybody should do it. It's so easy to do. And there's no restrictions, no rules, nothing. It's just plant a row for the hungry.
And you don't, do you have to like, do you sign up for the program just to say, hey, I'm part of it or?
You certainly can.
Okay.
And you can go to the Garden Writers and a website and there's a place where you can report your poundage and you can get signs for your garden, community garden, a plant a row marker and et cetera, et cetera. But you don't need to because this is what it's about. It's about gardeners sharing again, you know, not just information, but food too, because stuff goes to waste. I mean, that's stupid.
Yes.
Why give it to the moose? That's what I say. Why give it to the moose?
Yeah. I posted a picture of a moose on our Facebook page to talk about the challenges of growing gardening in Alaska, and that is a problem.
Yeah.
We have squirrels and rats.
It is a problem, I got to tell you.
So it's been great having you on, Jeff. We could talk for hours, of course, but we kind of have to wrap it up. Can you let our listeners know where you might be speaking next and any new projects that you're starting?
Well, actually, I'm speaking at the cannabis event in Colorado on the 27th and 28th.
Excellent.
And I can't remember where.
Okay.
I have a website, www.jefflowenfels.com, which I very rarely get to, but I'm going to start trying to keep up with it.
Okay.
And maybe they can go there. And my columns are every Friday at www.adn.com, should you want to garden in zone 3456 in Alaska
awesome.
Style.
Awesome.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you so much for being on the show and taking the time, and safe travels.
Well, thank you very much. Let's do it again. It was certainly a lot of fun.
Okay.
Thanks.
Take
Thanks.
Care.
You gave us a good light on Alaska. It's lovely.
Yeah, good. I appreciate it. Thank you
thank
so much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Well,
right out.
Well, that was a big show about a big state.
Yeah.
thank you guys for listening. You've been listening to We Dig Plants. You can follow us on Twitter at We Dig Plants to stay current on our projects and upcoming shows. Or you can follow us on Instagram at We Dig Plants, Groundworks Gardens NYC. Next month, we're going to go to Zone 2.
Zone 2.
Even colder. See you next month, and thanks for listening.
Happy gardening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.